Good morning. I'm going to carry on this morning's theme by talking about something completely different. And I'm going to talk mainly about the diversity of cellulolytic genes in forest soils. Generally speaking, fungal ecology seems to lag a little bit behind bacterial ecology in its application of molecular tools. Despite this, over the course of the last 10 years, the use of ribosomal tools, or ribosomal genes and the tools associated with them, has become almost standard. Nevertheless, functional gene analyses of fungi still seem to be very much in their infancy. Probably the best system at the moment for functional genes and fungi is the lignin decomposition system. Lignin is a complex organic polymer. It's present in the secondary plant cell wall. It's highly resistant to microbial degradation, and it therefore tends to retard litter decomposition in forest systems. And it's broken down primarily by fungi through the use of lignin peroxidase, manganese peroxidase, or lactase genes. And in the last few years, through the works of people like D'Souza and Lewis and Lyons, we've developed degenerate primer sets that let us amplify lactase genes for basidiomycetes and ascomycetes, which allow us to look at the diversity in various systems, and perhaps more importantly, to look at the factors that affect gene expression. Cellulose is the primary component of plant cell walls, and it's a polymer of glucose. It makes an excellent substrate for microorganisms with maybe a couple of limiting factors. One is that it's a large polymeric, well, it isn't polymeric, it's a monomer, a large compound. It's primarily crystalline. It's insoluble. It's difficult to degrade. Its degradation requires the action of a cellulolytic enzyme system that comprised of endogluconases, cellobiohydrolases, and beta-glucosidase. Now, although we know that we need these enzymes to break the system down, fungal ecologists still largely rely on the isolation and cultivation of species at various stages of litter decomposition to examine community effects. We're interested in maybe going a little bit beyond that then, and we decided to focus on cellobiohydrolase. Cellobiohydrolase is processed along cellulase chains, stripping cellooligosaccharides away from the crystalline matrix. There is some suggestion that they may be the key enzyme during the colonization and early exploitation of cellulose, with endogluconases being more effective later on when much of the cellulose has actually been depolymerized, broken down into a more soluble form. There are two types of cellobiohydrolase. They used to be known as CFAM and BFAM. They're now known much more catchily as CBH1 and CBH2. They do essentially the same thing. They process down the chain from the non-reducing end. CBH1 genes also have the capacity to act from the reducing end, which means they can strip a chain from both ends simultaneously. Pure culture studies suggest that CBH1 expression is often very, very much greater than CBH2. Cellobiohydrolases are now increasingly classified on the basis of their amino acid sequence similarity. When we do that, CBH1 genes, well, we recognize three families of CBH1 genes, of CBH genes. CBH1 are found primarily in a family glucoside hydrolase 7, so GH7, CBH2, family GH6, and both CBH1 and CBH2-like proteins are found in family GH48. When we look at the proteins within those families, we find that GH7 is exclusively fungal, although it does contain both endogluconases and cellobiohydrolases. Family GH6 contains an awful lot of fungi, but mainly bacteria. And GH48 is also mainly bacterial with a few fungal genes. We decided, therefore, to target GH7, the exclusively fungal family, for our primer design. The gene encodes for approximately 500 amino acids. And the protein structure has what is considered a typical tripartite structure with a long catalytic domain, a small linker region, and a small carbohydrate binding domain. Of the three regions, the most conserved is the carbohydrate binding domain, which would tend to make it a good choice for primers. Unfortunately, carbohydrate binding domains seem to be sort of flexible add-ons for a wide variety of enzymes, including xylanases and pectinases. So instead, we decided to target the catalytic domain itself. There has been previous work on primers for this, mainly for people interested in pure culture work. Some of the earliest, for example, Shepard et al. Amplified a roughly 100 base pair region of the catalytic domain. Unfortunately, they don't discriminate between endogluconases and cellobiohydrolases. They're also moderately degenerate. And the fraction itself at 100 base pairs is not particularly informative. I added this group here from Anishi et al. It came out just a couple of months ago. They amplify almost the entire catalytic domain. They are supposedly selective for cellobiohydrolases, but I put them on here mainly because they have, I think, the most degenerate primer I've ever seen, and I'm actually quite surprised it works. We made use of the entire selection of cellobiohydrolase information currently available in GenBank, which is approximately 50 sequences. We did a full amino acid alignment. We targeted two regions within the catalytic domain that had moderate sequence similarity. This actually here is the site of catalysis, and these three amino acids are the acid-base donors. And we were able, in that way, to first pick conserved motifs that would be useful, and then go back to the DNA to examine codon bias in the wobble regions, and in doing so, cut down the degeneracy. So we ended up with primers that were less degenerate, more specific for cellobiohydrolases. The important question is, do they work? This gel suggests that yes, they probably do. We were expecting to have fragments of at least 500 base pairs, so they should have come in somewhere around here. On the left-hand side of the slide, you see the PCR products that we got from pure cultures and sporocarps of both ascomycete and basidiomycete species. They range from about 520 to 620 base pairs in length, suggesting the presence of introns in most of them. And then on the right-hand side, we have the PCR results that we got from environmental samples. In this case, we have the litter and soil from two contrasting forest types in upper lower Michigan that we actually have quite a lot of fungal data for. One's an oak-dominated forest with a very lignin-rich litter, and one's a maple-dominated forest with litter that comes as close to being bug candy as you can find. And here again, we see a heterogeneous products in every one. So we cloned and sequenced the products from these. We examined for presence of introns, stripped the introns out, translated. We did the same for the clone libraries that we generated from the open maple. And what we ended up with is an enormous tree. And I realize you cannot probably read the taxa names from where you're sitting, but I'm actually going to talk you through that, so please don't strain your eyes. The tree contains, at the moment, about 103 sequences. The black lines represent the reference sequences that we pulled from GenBank. They go from Trichoderma over here up to, what's up here, Volvariella, so an agaric. The new sporocarp sequences are in red. Most of my sporocarps are basidiomycetes. They cluster around here. There's an ascomycete here, Sarcocytha, which is a wood-decomposing ascomycete. Xylaria in this group here. And then the environmental sequences, which are in blue. You can see the environmental sequences sit themselves in pretty much across the entire tree. Things to note here. I've colored little dots up here for you showing basidiomycetes in purple, ascomycetes in white. And you can see that as you move along the tree, we actually discriminate between ascomycete and basidiomycete cellobiohydrolase, which is quite useful. Other things to notice, from the 8 species that we got sporocarp sequences from, we ended up with 21 unique amino acids. And you can see little clusters here. This is Clytocybe gibber, another Clytocybe gibber. We see, I think, 3 here coming out of Xylaria. Fungi often have both allelic forms of CBH1 genes and, in many cases, gene families, so slightly different versions of the same gene in their genome. And the important implication of that is that when we pull out something like 47 putative amino acid sequences from a soil, that doesn't mean we necessarily have 47 species. We just have 47 different types of gene. The other interesting thing about this is that not only does the tree pull out ascomycetes from basidiomycetes, but when we go back to the literature and look at the kind of decomposition that these species specialize in, we can see a split into 3 nutritional guilds. We have down here what would be considered ascomycete microfungi, which are primarily cellular lytic in their action. We have a cluster in the middle that includes Xylaria as well as plant pathogens that would be considered to be primarily pectinolytic. And then we have a cluster at the end, the last three clays, that includes all of the basidiomycetes and a couple of fairly interesting ascomycetes that would be considered to be primarily lignanocellulolytic. So we have functional gills. And the final thing to pull out of this is out of these 47 amino acid sequences that we pulled out of the soils, we were able to identify exactly two. So 45 of them are completely unknown. And that's sort of where the functional guilds come in useful, because we can actually use those to start describing our two different forest types. At the top here, we have, for the two libraries combined, a comparison between litter and soil. And we see that lignocellulitic fungi are divided almost equally between the litter and the soil environment. There's actually no overlap in enzyme type, completely different communities, but equally distributed in terms of their diversity. We see the contrasting effect for the pectinolytic and cellulolytic genes. Pectinolytic were recovered almost exclusively from the litter layer, and that may reflect the understory, which in late summer is still providing fresh, moderately undegraded material. Cellulolytic fungi, which we'd expect to find maybe in the early stages of leaf litter decomposition, we actually found them primarily in the soil, where they may be targeting roots. When we look at the two libraries separately, and we look at the proportion of clones represented by each of these three groups, we see a very big contrast between the oak system, where the majority of clones fell into the lignocellulolytic class, and the maple system, which has a more even distribution amongst the three classes, which actually suggests a greater diversity maybe of ascomycetes. And these results, both the differences between the soil and the litter, and the differences between the two forests, we've also found previously with ribosomal genes and with lactase genes. So the cellulase seems to be doing quite a nice job of giving us information that we can believe. So in summary, we've developed primers that allow the recovery of a GH7 cellobiohydrolase hydrolase fragment. The putative amino acid sequence appears to be informative at both a taxonomic and an ecological level. And in the late summer, we can easily distinguish between litter and soil in forest communities in Michigan. And we can easily distinguish between forest types. At present, we're looking at maybe developing GH7 endogluconase primers, which would enable us to follow the decomposition process more fully. And we're obviously working at gene expression in complex communities. Thanks for your time. Okay, the question was, did we find any ectomycorrhizal fungi? And it's actually an excellent question. We know that the oak forest is, at least in the soil, almost 100% ectomycorrhizal. And we are nevertheless pulling out cellulase genes from that environment. I've just finished working my way through 50 new isolates that include about 30 ectomycorrhizal basidiomycetes. And in about two-thirds of them, I'm getting a product that looks very much like it's going to be a cellulase gene, yes. There's no real reason to expect them not to have cellulase genes. What we don't know is whether they actually use them, but that's definitely something we're looking at now, yes. Cindy. Yes. We do typically do a full range of enzyme activities anyway, so yes, we'll be fielding up. We're combining the two together, traditional approaches and the molecular approach.
I have a question. Was the CDH1 gene originally isolated from Rickettsia?
Yes. Most of the cellulase genes were actually originally pulled out of Trichoderma ricci, and then again from Phanerochaete chrysosporae.
I think a lot of bacteria also have been shown to produce cellulases. Have you found that? Do you know the differences or how different they are, the cellulase genes from bacteria compared to fungi? And can you tell from a functional, the genes that they're from bacteria?
The question is, can you tell the difference between bacterial and fungal functional genes? Yes, sort of. You can in GH7 because there are no bacterial genes. In terms of their structure, many bacteria produce cellulase genes with very similar catalytic domains, but no carbohydrate binding domain, B. because they actually work by surface contact rather than releasing an exoenzyme into solution. So if you had the whole gene, you should be able to tell the difference. From a fragment like this, it's not clear that you could.